Well, hello, listeners. Here again is Andrew Herod joining you for Islam in Focus, regularly occurring Blog Talk radio show here with United West on Global Patriot Radio, usually appearing at noon on Friday, some days at other hours, today at 1 p.m. I'd hope to join you today with a guest, Amil Imani, a Iranian-American expatriate, to talk about the past, present, and future of Iran, of course, a country that is much in the news these days with its long-term protests in the country and various tensions with the United States over matters such as, for example, the American killing of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran. He is, however, called in sick, so we will not be joined by Amil Imani today. Perhaps I'll try to get him on next week or another time. So I think I will just go over some recent writings I've done on Iran at the website Jihad Watch of Robert Spencer, where I'm a regular contributor, to look at the history of Iran and the ongoing historical tensions between Iranian nationalism, Iranian indigenous culture, and the religion of Islam that came to Iran originally in the 7th century under Arab Islamic conquest. So recently, if you want to call in or join me in the chat room, you can call in at 319-527-6706, 319-527-6706, and join me for this conversation, not leave me alone here, and we can carry on. So, or you can send in questions at the chat room online to the online studio. Well, recently I've written several articles on Iran as part of a continuing series looking at Iran and Iranian history. I started out at Jihad Watch with an article earlier this month on January 17th called Iran First Iranians Protest Islamic Rule. The article noted various analysts who've examined Iranian nationalism, Iranian nationalists, and noted that they have an Iran First outlook, as it is called, rejecting any ideology of this Islamic Republic that came to power in Iran in 1979 with the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini's overthrow of the then Shah of Iran, the ruling monarch of Iran from the Pahlavi dynasty that came to power in 1925 and ruled Iran from 1925 to 1979 under first the Reza Pahlavi, the father of the first Shah and the father then of Muhammad Shah, Muhammad Reza Pahlavi Shah, who came to power in 1941 after the British and Soviet Union invaded Iran from both north and south, respectively, out of fears that the pro-Axis, pro-German Shah might align with Germany and allow Germany to use the territory of Iran for against the Allies fighting World War II. Now, in these recent protests that erupted both in December of 2017 and then more recently in November of 2019 are still ongoing, there have been various chants that have been reported from these protesters. For example, as the article notes, there's some protesters have chanted in 2017 that Iranian protesters have chanted that we are Ari or Aryan race and we don't worship Arabs. And this ties into a theme that Iranian nationalists reject Islam or are skeptical of Islam as being just really a foreign import from an Arab Islamic conquest in the 7th century. And it's important to note that Iran, unlike other countries that under these similar Arab Islamic conquests in the 7th century, like if you think of Egypt or North Africa, Iran preserved its language and much of its culture even as it came under Islamic domination, Islamic rule, and much of the society was Islamicized, whereas other countries like Egypt, other societies in Egypt and North Africa became fully Arabized, and their language today is Arabic. They think of themselves as part of a broader Arabic community. The nations of Egypt or Libya, say, are in the Arab League. So there's a notable difference between Iran and Persia, and the other societies in the Middle East that became Arabized through these Islamic conquests. There have been all sorts of other chants like, we don't want an Islamic Republic, and clerics, shame on you, let go of our country. Others have made chants supporting the Shah, saying, Reza Shah, bless your soul. A clear reference to this Pahlavi dynasty that was very pro-Western, very sort of secularizing, that now masses of Iranians are rejecting these four decades of Islamic Republic rule and are demanding a return to a more secular, westernized regime, and so looking to the Shah then as a symbol. Others have chanted, what a mistake we made by taking part in the revolution, and that Iran is haphazard without the Shah. So these are very interesting protests. Also, you have protests against Iranians protesting, saying things like, for example, not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran. This new Islamic Republic that came to power in 1979 under the Ayatollah's first Ayatollah Khomeini as the first supreme leader, as it's called, the ruler of Iran in this theocracy in Iran. Ultimately, all power resides with the supreme leader and clerical bodies like the Assembly of Experts that you might hear say elections in Iran for parliament. But it's important to understand that any and all such candidates for such elections in such a parliament, this majlis, must go through a pre-clearance process with the theocratic rulers of Iran to even run an election. So it's you can maybe make the analogy of this Islamic Republic of Iran to, say, apartheid South Africa, right? In order to even participate in this electoral process, you have to satisfy a certain precondition. In the case of this Islamic Republic of Iran, you have to satisfy these theocratic masters of this Shiite Islamic Republic, whereas in South Africa, of course, the deciding criteria was your skin color. In order to have a right to vote, you had to be white, or later there was some minor additions of allowing so-called colored mixed race individuals some voting power. But of course, the apartheid system then really just shut out the dominant black majority of South Africa. So it's a sort of similar process in Iran. You might want to think about that anytime someone talks about elections, that the president of Iran or this parliament of Iran, they really ultimately don't matter. It is indeed this Iranian supreme leader now, Ali Khamenei, who calls the shots in conjunction with theocratic institutions like the Assembly of Experts. These recent protests then that are bringing into question the survival of the regime have brought up this rejection of Islamic rule and a sense that Islam throughout Iran's history, these past 1,400 years, is something that's been imposed upon it to the detriment of national Iranian culture. One person whom I quote, for example, in the article is an Iranian expatriate author Amir Tahiri, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. In his book, The Persian Night, he has written that the overwhelming majority of Iranian writers, poets, and other producers of culture reject Khomeiniism, that is, this rule in the name of the system of that Ayatollah Khomeini set up in 1979, as a form of anti-Iranian fascism. And other Iranian expatriates, an individual I cite, Sheda Vazighi, has written about Iranians having struggled for 14 centuries not to be a part of a homogenous Islamic Arab world. This brings into questions that there's longstanding criticisms of the Islamic faith that it's really just an ethnocentric Arab-based faith. If, for example, if you read the books by the late great West Indian writer V.S. Naipaul, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature, that he wrote two books in 1979 and then later in 1983, right after the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the first one called Among the Believers and the second one called Beyond the Belief, in which he toured these non-Arab Islamic countries of Iran, Pakistan, and then in Southeast Asia, the greater Malay culture of Malaysia and Indonesia, and examined the role of Islam in among these non-Arab peoples, and explored this theme of how these non-Arab peoples had come to embrace or accept as part of their identity this faith originating in an Arab prophet in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century. And in one of his books, for example, he went to Indonesia and talked with an Indonesian Muslim there and received his visiting card, his business card, and looked at his name, and he said, look at his first and middle and last names, and V.S. Naipaul said, look, those are all Arab names. And the Muslim Indonesian responded, no, those are all Muslim names. And V.S. Naipaul noted that in sort of the identity of any devout Muslims in these countries, they really identify then with the ascendance of Islam in their countries, even in most of these countries, in Iran or in Pakistan, even though it came at the point of conquest, that they identify then precisely with these Arab armies that came into their ancestral lands and overthrew the pre-existing rulers and civilizations in the country. So this case of Iran today really highlights this issue of tensions with or interactions with conflicts between Islamic ideology and any indigenous culture, because particularly in this case of the Islamic Republic of Iran, you have a country that's come to power, a regime that's come to power proclaiming this universal vision of trying to, from Iran, go beyond and set up some sort of global Shiite Islamic rule, that Iran's going to become the center of a global Islamic revolution that will end in some sort of Shiite caliphate, a rule by a Shiite imam, sort of parallel to, say, Sunni visions of a caliphate among groups like Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State under Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. This is then the Shiite version in Iran. In another article, for example, I pointed out another recent article at Jihad Watch that just came out a couple of days ago. It is entitled "A Country, A Cause, Not a Country: Iran's Islamic Republic." And there, various analysts, for example, the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change in the United Kingdom, have noted that this Iranian state serves the revolution, not the other way around. So, according to the Shiite theocracy in Iran, the interests of the regime are not any regular interests in terms of the well-being of the people of Iran or the strengthening of any particular national power in Iran, but the fundamental overriding interest of this Islamic Republic in Iran is to serve this Islamic revolution. And in their analysis at this Institute for Global Change in the United Kingdom, they've examined the various speeches of the Islamic Republic's leaders and noted how they're all really committed Islamists. They're committed to a political vision of Islam, and that comes through in all their speeches. For example, it is a common practice for these leaders in the Islamic Republic of Iran to begin their speeches with Arabic prayers, something which was, of course, not usual under the authorities, under the Shah of Iran, under his monarchy. In this context, it's important to understand that Islam is in its doctrine, in its historic Orthodox doctrine, is against nationalism. The fundamental community in Islam is what is called the Ummah, the community of believers, an Arabic word, Ummah, related to the word in Arabic, meaning mother. Okay, so you're supposed to have, it's this new community of your kindred kind within a community of faith. Raymond Ibrahim, for example, in his book on Sword and Scimitar, discussing centuries of jihad by Islamic powers against the West, against what was historically called Christendom, has noted that Islam developing within the Arabic culture of the 7th century really a sort of repackaged an Arabic tribal culture. And so it's kind of a theological justification or a theological repackaging of 7th century Arabic culture such that the tribe that you have allegiance to, which you owe your allegiance, is no longer any individual Arabic tribe among the various tribes in the Arabian Peninsula that used to have rivalries with each other and fight each other. But now, according to this supposed Arabic prophet Muhammad, the new tribe is the Islamic community, your community of faith, the Ummah. And so then this tribal, this sort of tribal-based faith of Islam then spread through conquest throughout the Middle East. It was often then adopted, as Raymond Ibrahim has analyzed, by other historically tribal peoples, like, for example, the Turks, who then went on to lead later the great Ottoman empire in the name of Islam, that they found this Islamic ideology, this Islamic faith, sort of congenital. It really corresponded to their tribal understandings of society. And so, or elsewhere in Central Asia, in Afghanistan, you had other tribal peoples that really found this Islamic ideology made sense for them in their understanding of man and God. So then this Islamic orthodoxy opposes the idea that Muslims should divide themselves according to nationhood. You can make a sort of a clear distinction then between Islam and biblical revelation, the Bible, we have one person checking into the chat room here. Maybe he will give us a question. We can talk to him. But in the Bible, I mean, one, beginning with the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, as Christians say, you have, of course, a specific nation, the Jews, who are a light unto the nations. So right there, you have throughout the Bible, then in the Jewish scriptures, you deal with this Jewish nation and how it's supposed to interact with other peoples and influence other peoples, that this Jewish nation is supposed to be an example for other nations. So right there, you have an emphasis on nationhood. I mean, this Jewish American Israeli writer Yoram Hazoni, who's recently written a well-known book on the importance of nationalism. I mean, he would of course, from his own background, understand this, that the Bible emphasizes the importance of specific nations like the Jewish nation. I mean, God works through a Jewish nation, and Jewish rabbis have noted, like Rabbi Jonathan Sacks in the United Kingdom, have noted that in the understanding of Judaism, you have, on the one hand, you have a particular Jewish culture, you have particular Jewish religious laws, which are only applicable to this one single culture of Jews, this one nation of Jews. But then you have universal moral laws that are applicable to all of humanity. And so there's then a balance that all of humanity has to follow certain moral laws for there to be peace and justice. But on the other hand, Jews are not supposed to impose their one particular culture upon other nations. There's then supposed to be an equality of various peoples, of various nations that have their own unique backgrounds and unique cultures. And then, of course, dealing with the Christian scriptures, the New Testament, you also then have there, obviously, an emphasis as well on different nations. I mean, this gospel message is taken to different peoples who embrace that message, and yet they remain distinct peoples. Just because you become Christian, you accept the claims of this Jewish Messiah, Jesus, does not mean that you abandon your own unique culture. We all remain, Christians all remain from different unique backgrounds, whether they're in Germany or Japan or the United States. And then, of course, in the book of Revelation, you have reference to all of these nations going before the judgment of the Lord. There are all these different peoples who are going to come together before God, as well as, for example, Pentecost, where you have this outpouring of the Holy Spirit on these disciples in Jerusalem, that there are all of these various Jewish believers from various backgrounds in Jerusalem. They all then speak in tongues. The Holy Spirit comes to them, and they speak in tongues, and so they they speak this message of the Holy Spirit to all sorts of people gathered for Shavuot in Jerusalem at the time of Pentecost, and they speak in various languages to all of these people about the coming of the Holy Spirit. So there again, you have an emphasis on different peoples with different languages. But I make the analogy that in contrast to Christianity speaking in tongues, the Holy Spirit speaking in tongues, Islam, of course, speaks in Arabic. The language of revelation is Arabic. You're supposed to do your prayers in Arabic. You may only properly read the Quran really in Arabic. It's always contended that, according to Islamic doctrine, that any translation of the Quran is just merely a kind of an approximation, but to truly read the Quran, you have to read it in Arabic, because after all, this Quran is the supposedly preserved revelation of God that has coexisted with God for all of eternity, and the language of that revelation is indeed in Arabic. So to have to truly read this revelation that is co-eternal with God, you have to read it in its supposedly perfect Arabic language. And this leads to practices that, for example, Paul Marshall, who's a scholar of religious freedom and religions in this, done a lot of, has worked, written books in conjunction with the Hudson Institute and other think tanks, and has had extensive experience dealing with issues of religious freedom in Indonesia, has noted at past presentations, for example, at the Westminster Institute here in the Washington, D.C. area, out in McLean, Northern Virginia, that Arabs will often go to Indonesia and express a sense of superiority, that they are indeed Arabs, they're the people of revelation, they have the language, the culture of revelation, and so they're the ones who truly understand Islam. Whereas all these Indonesians, Arabic is not their native language, it's a form of Malay, a dialect of Malay, and they come from this culture which has been very sort of historically syncretic, mixing of various religions that have been present throughout Indonesian history, of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity, of Indonesian mosques, mixing, for example, different design elements. And so there's then often expressed among these Arabs a sense of superiority, that they're the ones who truly know Islam. So Iran highlights this issue of a tension between an indigenous culture, its own nationhood in a place like Iran, and any vision of a universal Islamic order and of adherence to Islamic orthodoxy. I remember one Muslim American I know here in the Washington, D.C. area, I've written about it. Her name is Saba Ahmed, a Pakistani American, and I've written about her, and she once, for a while back, she presented herself as some sort of Muslim Republican, and I investigated her and found out that she was actually a 9/11 truther who made all sorts of, advocate all sorts of crazy theories about how on September 11th, 2001, it was actually a controlled explosion that destroyed the World Trade Center, or that there was the Department of Defense sort of faked an attack on the Pentagon with maybe perhaps having a drone that looked like an airplane. She's posted things online on Facebook talking about how Pakistanis and Turks are all one people because they're Muslims. But if you think about that, that's just an absurdity to say that simply because Turks and Pakistanis are Muslim that they can somehow form one community, even with Pakistan itself. This idea to have a purely Islamic state formed by all of the Muslims in South Asia, in the Indian subcontinent, following Indian independence from British rule in 1947, there then, in the name of this Pakistani ideology, all Muslims are supposed to they're supposed to be the partition of the Indian subcontinent into a Hindu majority India and a supposedly all Islamic Pakistan, which is what the name Pakistan in Urdu means. It means land of the pure. This is supposed to be some sort of purely Muslim society, and it did indeed pronounce itself upon independence and forming its own constitution a couple of years later as an Islamic Republic. But even there, if you think of the 1971 war between what was West Pakistan, now we know as just the country of Pakistan, the main body of Pakistan, and then, crazily enough, the other part of Pakistan was East Pakistan, on the whole other side of the Indian subcontinent near Calcutta, which is now, in 1971, fought this independence war to ultimately become Bangladesh, in Muslim-majority Bengal. That part of Bengal during Indian partition was divided between a Hindu-majority of Bengal, where Calcutta is today in India, and a Muslim-majority of Bengal, which then became first part Pakistan and then now Bangladesh, simply purely on the basis of religion. It's as Indian college classmates discussed with me when I was in college many years ago, in particular to Sumantra Bose, a classmate of mine in 1992 at Amherst College, who's now a professor at the London School of Economics and came from India and came from a well-known Indian political family and has specialized in issues of studying Indian political conflict and ethnic conflict. He discussed with me how all of these Bengals, whether they're in Calcutta and in what was West Bengal, or now in what was East Bengal and later became Pakistan and then Bangladesh, it's all the same people. The only fundamental difference is which of these regions of Bengals, which of these groups of Bengals became Muslim in the process of Indian history with Islamic conquest and the spread of Islam throughout the Indian subcontinent. So there, this idea that peoples can be form a nation together just because they're Muslim, even there it broke down. Or you can look at, for example, people from historically Christian societies, just because the United Kingdom comes from a Christian background, like the rest of Europe, doesn't mean that the people of the United Kingdom can necessarily engage in any particular form of political integration with another people, like in the European Union. Again, precisely a biblical understanding would indicate that although peoples like the British or the French or Americans might have similar religious beliefs or similar moral beliefs or a certain similar society, we all remain, however, unique in whatever our particular local conditions are. The things I face as an American and my background are just not the same as, say, a Canadian or a Mexican or a British person, and we all have sort of unique communities, and we have to deal with our own unique problems and issues with our own solutions. We can't really centralize power in one political institution that's going to somehow solve all of our problems. I have a few people come in here into the chat room. If you have any questions, just send them to me, and I'll try to deal with them as I'm here on the show. We're about at the midway mark of our hour-long show here, so I'd like to have any more questions come in, or if you want to call in, again, my number, our guest call-in number is 319-527-6706, so I don't just stay alone here. If I could have some more conversation with other people, and you can bring some suggestions. So, and in particular, in the case of Iran, I've looked at the history of, in its indigenous culture and Iranian nationalism, one key episode in Iranian history and key figure is that of the Achaemenid, if I'm saying that right, empire from ancient history that was established by the Emperor Cyrus the Great in 559 BC or BCE, before the Common Era or before Christ, however you wish to term that, and then lasted until its overthrow in 330 BCE, following the 332 BCE Battle of Gaugamela under Alexander the Great, the famous Macedonian who then became ruler of the Greek city-states, and then proceeded to create a massive empire throughout the ancient world. He overthrew this Achaemenid empire that was founded by Cyrus the Great. But for over 200 years, or about 200, a little over 200 years, this empire lasted. It was founded by Cyrus the Great, who overthrew the Babylonian Empire, actually rather peacefully, because the Babylonian population was angered by their rulers disrespecting local gods. And so Cyrus the Great was able to overthrow it. And he's noted in history for this, what is known as the Cyrus Cylinder, a baked clay cylinder with a cuneiform lettering on it that gives a message, a royal decree, which he issued in 539 upon his advance into Babylon, proclaiming that he would respect local culture and local religions and have religious tolerance. So he conquered these various empires and communities and brought them into his empire, but he proclaimed this tolerance for local customs and local faith. In particular, he's noted in the Bible, in the Jewish scriptures, for having allowed the Jews who were in this Babylonian captivity after Nebuchadnezzar II, the Babylonian emperor, in 586 BC had conquered Judea and brought most of the Jews into his captivity in the Babylonian Empire. He set these Jews free and allowed them to go back to Jerusalem and Judea, and actually gave support for the rebuilding of the Jewish temple after the first temple had been destroyed by the Babylonians. So sometimes people are referred to Cyrus the Great as the world's first Zionist. Harry Truman, for example, in 1947, when he led as president, he led the United States in recognizing the newly established state of Israel that proclaimed its independence first there's the UN resolution supporting a partition plan, 1947, November of 1947, and later Israel proclaimed its independence in May of 1948, and Harry Truman led the United States recognizing the new state of Israel, and Harry Truman supposedly proclaimed, "I am Cyrus," that he, like Cyrus, had contributed then to this restoration of a Jewish homeland, a Jewish state. So historians have often celebrated Cyrus the Great as this really early example of ancient example of tolerance, and that indeed this toleration was what allowed his empire to survive, that he allowed for local rule, local preservation of customs, and although other historians say that there's a little bit of mythology there in dealing with Cyrus, that he was often could be just as brutal as any other ruler in the ancient world. But for Iranians, as many expatriate Iranians have noted, Cyrus and his cylinder are a source of really intense national pride. But this memory of Cyrus is something, of course, that cuts against the Islamic Republic in Iran, which again denounces the idea of nationalism as dividing this community of Muslim believers, the Ummah. The Ayatollah Khomeini, for example, when he was in exile in Iraq, when the Shah was in power in Iran, condemned in 1976 the fact that the Shah had replaced the traditional Islamic calendar, which has its starting date the year of what we would call 622 AD, according to the Western Judeo-Christian based calendar based on the birth of Jesus, The Islamic calendar has its year one in 622 AD, where Muhammad and some of his initial followers left the city of Mecca in the Arabian Peninsula for the neighboring city of Medina, and there first formed a state to rule under Muhammad. So this first foundation of a political state, an Islamic political state, and that is the year one for the Islamic calendar. The Shah of Iran replaced that calendar with a royal calendar, which he dated from the beginning of the Achaemenid Empire in 559. And he also, the Ayatollah Khomeini in 1976 denounced this attempt by the Shah to create a new Iranian calendar that was based on this memory, this Iranian memory of the Achaemenid Empire. And also in particular, the Shah of Iran engaged in this massive celebration in 1971, which was supposed to also mark then the 2,500th anniversary of the death of Cyrus the Great, to the end of his life in 529 BCE. And then the foundation of this Achaemenid Empire, he had a massive, really luxurious celebration in 1971 at Persepolis, which is the historic site where the remains are of the empire, the capital of the Achaemenid Empire. And he invited all of these world leaders and celebrities and various reigning monarchs from Europe to come and engage in this lavish, luxurious celebration. So this goes to show just how the Shah of Iran was trying to emphasize Iranian culture, Iranian nationalism. Today, there were, right following the revolution in 1979, there were actually some attempts by some Iranian clerics to destroy the historic site at Persepolis, as well as to destroy the tomb nearby of Cyrus the Great at a place called Pasargadae, if I'm saying that right. Pasargadae, if I'm saying that right, is where his tomb is. And this tomb today in the Iranian Republic, and particularly in recent years, has become a sort of a pilgrimage site for various Iranians, Iranian nationalist-minded Iranians who try to go there on what is called Cyrus Day, which is often considered the day, October 29th, that Cyrus supposedly began his conquest of Babylon. And so there have been, particularly in 2016, there was a mass demonstration at Pasargadae of Iranians going there. The regime tried to really crack down on this and stop this. They put up roadblocks on roads to the tomb of Cyrus the Great, and they ended up arresting various event leaders. There were there various anti-regime slogans expressed. And, for example, one Ayatollah condemned the protesters as counter-revolutionaries because the protesters has chanted things like, "Iran is our country, Cyrus is our father," and as well as the chant, "Freedom of thought cannot take place with beards," namely the beards habitually worn by Iran's ruling Muslim clerics. And so in recent years, like in the following year, 2017, the Islamic Republic again put up roadblocks and tried to block demonstrators from going to this tomb and holding demonstrations. And also demanded pledges from previous event leaders that they would no longer lead such demonstrations. So these are some issues I'm exploring then in this continuing series at Jihad Watch of looking at Iran's past and the interaction with the conflicts between Islamic doctrine on the one hand and its universal claims and any Iranian indigenous culture. So perhaps next week I'm not really getting any questions here. No one's calling in to join me and discuss these issues involving Iran. So I guess I don't have much more to add, but we will try to get on a guest next week for our show so we can have a little more interactive experience and bring someone else in other than just me, although I hope you enjoy also listening to me. Perhaps we can get Amil Imani in then next week, and he can give his own insight from a person who grew up in Iran under the Shah and then later left Iran after the Islamic Revolution, and he can discuss these issues further. I've quoted him in some of my articles, and I will continue in the coming month of February to write some more articles on these issues. And you can read about them at Jihad Watch. So I look forward to talking to you again. We'll sign off here, but you can join us again every Friday, usually at noon. We try to host a show. Sometimes it varies with the schedule to what I'm doing on that particular day when I broadcast the schedule, but at least you can tune in online and listen to the archive episodes. So I look forward to talking to you again. I thank you very much. Bye.